Okay, thank you. We'll now move into regs, and Commissioner Friedkin is coming out of airplane. I'm unable to attend this particular meeting, so he's our regs chairman, so I will chair this. The first order of business is the approval of the previous committee meeting minutes from the November 3rd, 2010 meeting, which have already been distributed. Do I have a motion to approve?
So moved.
Commissioner Bivens. And all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Thank you all. Before we get started, I want to mention the following items have been withdrawn. And I'm going to ask Carter to explain a little bit why we're withdrawing this, because there's been a lot of work put into it. And it has to do with committee item number 4, revisions to exotic aquatic species rules and fees. Recommended adoption of proposed changes. We were going to vote on that tomorrow. This item that was planned for public comment and action tomorrow has been withdrawn. Okay. We also withdrawn the next one?
Yes, we are.
Okay. Committee item number 5, which was amendments to exotic species rules. That in that case, we were just going to request permission to publish proposed changes, and we also are going to withdraw that at this time. Carter, why don't you talk about that a little bit, because there's been so much work into that, kind of going back to the last legislature in Sunset and why it all got started.
Sure, absolutely. I think most of you know, in the last session and during the Sunset review of the agency, a recommendation came out that the agency prepare a white list as a framework for trying to proactively arrest the spread and dissemination of exotic invasive aquatic species. And really, over the period of the last year, colleagues from inland fisheries and law enforcement and wildlife and executive office and coastal fisheries have been working with stakeholders on trying to develop a whitelist framework that met the intent of the statute, which was clearly designed to try to do everything we could to proactively arrest the importation and spread of these species, but also to be as permissive as possible with respect to industry and so forth. We've had a lot of input. It's been an ever-moving target, really up until day before yesterday, our team was making adjustments and modifications to the proposed rules to submit to y'all. They've done an extraordinary job of being responsive to the input that we've received from constituents. I still think there's a lot of confusion out there about what a whitelist is and what it would actually say and do, and perhaps more importantly, not do. And so really at the behest of Senator Hager yesterday, who chairs the Sunset Committee, sponsored the legislation on this, has been a strong proponent of combating the spread of aquatic invasive species. He asked if we would take a pause and suspend our work on this until we had a chance really to sit down with him and go through and where we are on this and make sure this is still the approach that we want to take. He's been very, very sick over the last week, and so we have not been able to sit down with him, but he asked just if we would respectfully do that, and I think in accordance with that request from him, that's a prudent thing to do, and we look forward to sitting back down with him and talking about where we go from here. And so we'll report back to the commission on that at the next meeting.
So there's been thousands of hours of work put into this from the last legislature. But Senator Hager's been involved in that at a certain level, of course, more of a macro level, but it's very supportive of it. And there's so much involved in it. You know, when you kind of first get into it, you just focus on the science, you focus on the white list, you focus on the kind of things. And then we realized and started understanding, and of course, so did our constituency, for everything from the very large energy companies who were out there trying to figure out how to turn algae into energy, all the way to the nurserymen who were afraid that we were going to be jumping over their back fences, you know, making sure they weren't growing water lilies, okay, or something. And all of those people, as they realized what we were getting involved in and what this white list might entail, as they have a right to, decided, you know, they wanted to be involved and get involved. And so we've learned a lot, and there's probably a lot more to this. We need to be very careful on how we approach this going forward. So we wanted to honor Senator Hager's and others' request in legislation to put this on.
And please know, y'all have our commitment just to continue working with all of the stakeholders on this, as Chairman Holt said, from, you know, nurserymen to growers to industry, et cetera, to make sure that we devise something that, you know, everybody thinks is inherently workable, operational, enforceable, and accomplish the goals. So we're absolutely and unequivocally committed to that.
Is the decision to go from a blacklist to a whitelist because of the abundance of different types of exotic aquatic life? I mean, both types of lists seem formidable in enforcement. And I guess I'm just trying to go through the process of why the Sunset determined that it was best to go or reword what they recommended.
I think there are pros and cons of both approaches. Just to be fair, the blacklist is a situation in which, you know, those species that the department has identified that would cause danger to humans, health, the environment, the economy, those species couldn't be imported, possessed, or sold. Under that approach, then, you know, you'd have species that would come into the state that you didn't know about, and then once they got out and started to cause problems, you were then compelled to react after the fact. And so that's been an issue with a number of the species that y'all are very familiar with that are plaguing Texas waters right now. The concept behind the whitelist was, is there a way to do this more proactively, where you identify based on good science, here are the species that we know don't have invasive propensities and can be safely brought in and used in the state without causing damage to the state's economy or health or environment. And then if there were new species that folks wanted to bring in, it was incumbent upon them to show through science that they wouldn't cause harm. So that kind of put the onus on the individuals that wanted to bring it in. Again, there are pros and cons to both approaches. And we'll certainly work with y'all in the legislature to make sure that we have a framework that does address it. I think everybody agrees that invasive species are a major problem to the state, and we need to have some ability to help address them. How we do it has just been the subject of a lot of debate.
That is one part of the debate, right. No doubt about it. As some of the members of the Sunset and others look back, you know, which way to go, blacklist, whitelist, or some combination of, so law enforcement is obviously a big part of the issue.
It puts a lot of responsibility on us in our department to be able to determine the danger of the various species. I mean, we've got to really have a very vast knowledge. Amazing to me, just in the reading of what we've got so far, just the sheer number of species.
Oh yeah, well that's it. Of course, and there's, theoretically, there's even genetic work going on to try to, you know, create even more. No, that's one of the issues. And of course, you know, the white list, at least there, that you could argue is that the onus was on them, either the individual or the industry or whatever that's trying to bring this in or use it for some reason or whatever, or genetically change or create, to prove to us that it was not going to be a species that would create harm. Of course, that's created its own set of issues with certain constituents, and so we've got to work involved. But we felt it was a legitimate request, and Senator Hager has been a good friend of Texas Parks and Wildlife, and very strongly. Remember, he comes from, I don't know if you're aware of his background, but also a farming family, rice farming, and so invasive species is something that's very clear. They all take seriously down here, no doubt about it. He is going to see if we get this right, maybe the first time.
Sure.
So we certainly can put this vote off. They're not walking away from it. I think people want to spend a little more time on trying to figure out what is the right way to do it. Okay, any other questions or comments on that? Moving on then, update.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And I'm not going to report on any specific land and water action plan since you have the report card that I distributed earlier. I will mention one particular issue that I want to make sure you notice. There was a lot of news about the agency in December. And one of those bits of news was an extraordinary resolution, or hopefully leading to a resolution of a case that had been dormant for over 8 years, and it involved just a horrific hit-and-run boating accident on Lake Buchanan in which three teenagers from Lampasas were out fishing for catfish in the early hours of the morning when someone hit their boat and threw those three teenagers into the waters. One teenager was killed. Two others survived. And the individual left the scene. And, you know, despite extraordinary work over the years by our law enforcement division, particularly locally, Jim Lindeman, who's our game warden there in Lampasas County, knows those families that were impacted. We just haven't been able to catch who was responsible. The good news is, thanks to a tip from to Operation Game Thief, we received a tip about where the boat that was used in the accident was, and through some extraordinary law enforcement work done by the division and internal affairs and other local and state law enforcement authorities, were able to apprehend the suspect, who is now being charged with manslaughter. Really a great, great outcome. Great, very, very proud of our law enforcement officers that have worked on this. I think you'll be very interested to know that one of the young men that was in that accident that survived is now a game warden serving this agency up in, I guess, Knox County or up there. And just a wonderful individual, recent graduate academy in the last couple of years. And that incident and his interactions with our law enforcement team inspired him to take that career path. So we're real proud to have him on our team. And obviously he is bittersweet to see this happening after he lost such a close friend. But I want to compliment our law enforcement team and our internal affairs team that did an extraordinary job on working on this. Really great police work. Yes, sir.
Has this person been indicted yet?
He has, yeah.
How old the person, were there other, is he, and how,
were there other, is that, I mean, if it's public, Carl, you want to,
Pete Flores, Director of Law Enforcement, has that gone to the grand jury yet, but we expect
has
it to be,
not.
Has not, but will be going soon. They did a great job. I would also be remiss if I didn't mention our communications division. Did a great job handling the media on this. It got a lot of attention. It was very well handled and very professionally done. The boat was found buried. It had been buried for all these years, and of course there's statute of limitations when you have to do with leaving the scene of an accident and tampering with evidence. I believe there are a couple of bills have been filed by Representative Fletcher out of Tomball in this session to remedy that when it involves a death. That prosecution is going forward. And the wardens, especially Warden Lindeman, did a very good job, put his heart and soul to the case, and was a credit to the profession and to the agency.
How many years ago did that?
8 years. 8 years, Mr. Chairman. So it's a very good case.
It just seems crazy that there's a statute of limitation on concealing evidence.
There is. And
manslaughter case.
You're concealing evidence. Why doesn't that toll the statute?
Well, it's hopefully will be remedied this session, Commissioner, we'll see what happens. I believe it will be a positive outcome on that. So, yes, Sam Oatman is a district attorney in Llano, and he's also working with Representative Fletcher. I remember he's the lead contact with Representative Fletcher on that this filing of those statutes. But as so far as the prosecution, Sam Oatman is the lead district attorney in Llano.
He's trying to pursue the case.
He is pursuing the manslaughter case. Yes, and see that justice is done.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, that's all I have. Thank you.
Okay, great. Committee item number 2, 2011-2012, statewide hunting proclamation, question written, publish proposed changes in the Texas Register. Mr. Jason Hart, please. Jason.
Thank you, Chairman Holt, Commissioners. My name is Jason Harden, Upland Game Bird Specialist with Texas Parks and Wildlife. I'm here today to present proposed regulation changes impacting the wild turkey season structure and the mule deer managed land deer program. I'd like to start out by discussing three proposed regulation changes that, if accepted, will take effect during the 2011-2012 turkey season. These proposals were developed through our Upland Game Bird Technical Committee, consisting of Texas Parks and Wildlife staff, and these proposals were presented to the Upland Game Bird Advisory Committee during a briefing this past August and again in November. The Advisory Committee viewed the opinions of the Upland Game Bird Technical Committee favorably. The first proposal is to close 15 of the current 43 counties open for a spring eastern turkey season. The eastern turkey season is unique in Texas in that it's the only game animal in the state that is required to be reported following harvest. All harvested birds must be reported to one of our 90-plus mandatory check stations within 24 hours of harvest. The harvest data collected helps us to implement management strategies. The counties recommended for closure are delineated here in black and listed to the left of the map. Closures are recommended due to less than one bird on average being harvested, being reported for a minimum period of 3 years. Several of these counties have not reported a harvest for a much longer period.
Not a single bird?
Not a single bird for many of the counties. But on average, one bird for the last 3 years is our minimum period. Based on hunter, landowner, and parks and wildlife biologist observations, there appears to be a lack of brood stock in these counties to support a season. Closing these counties provides parks and wildlife the opportunity to move forward with a new super stocking strategy. As requested by the commission in November, parks and wildlife staff held several scoping meetings. These meetings were only lightly attended. However, the folks who did attend these meetings 100% supported closing these 15 counties. The Wildlife Division also provided our constituents with an opportunity to take an internet scoping survey. The results of that survey found over 86% of respondents supported the closure of those 15 counties. During this process, I also received several emails from some of our constituents that were in support of closing these counties. The commission requested that I provide information on future stocking strategies. The following information is simply an FYI for our new super stocking strategy. Parks and Wildlife stocked over 7,000 eastern wild turkeys into the former range in East Texas between 1979 and 2002 using a block stocking strategy that had worked in other southeastern states. 15 to 20 birds were stocked in locations throughout a county. The goal was to have the individual flocks establish themselves, reproduce, and eventually join up with other flocks stocked in that particular county. Although the strategy was successful in some parts of East Texas, many areas in East Texas were less successful. This slide shows an example of the block stocking strategy. There were several release sites in Anderson County from 1990 to 1997. Most of the release sites received a 15-bird stocking consisting of 12 females and 3 males. Today, there are no sustainable populations remaining from these historic releases. In 2007, Parks and Wildlife focused research on a new stocking strategy. This strategy, referred to as super stocking, focuses on stocking 80 eastern turkeys per release site, 60 hens, 20 gobblers. The results of this new method to date have been outstanding, with survival and production being reported as similar to that of other southeastern states that have established eastern turkey populations. The next step for staff is to identify the best available sites for future stockings. To accomplish this, staff are developing a new habitat suitability index. The index will utilize new technologies and research findings to identify those key variables that are needed to support a sustainable wild turkey population. The habitat suitability index will continue to be modified as we learn more through future stocking efforts. The second proposal is to delay the opening of the spring Easter turkey season by 2 weeks. The current season begins April 1st and runs through April 30th. Staff is proposing to delay the opening of the season by 2 weeks. The new season will open April 15th and run through May 14th. Research conducted in East Texas has identified a median nest initiation date falling in the middle of April. Research conducted in 2007 through 2008 looked at nest initiation data for 98 nesting attempts. The median nest initiation fell on April 16th. This change will assure that the majority of hens have been bred by the available gobblers before the season opens and reduce the risk of accidental hen harvest, because the majority of hens will be sitting on a nest and incubating eggs for up to 23 hours a day. Scoping meetings identified greater than 85% of attendance supported the season date shift. Internet scoping found 89% of respondents supported the season date shift. I did receive two emails from constituents that did not support the season date shift. The third proposal is to change the spring real grand turkey season in the north and south zones from a gobbler-only season to an any-bearded bird season. This change reflects the spring bag of most states with a spring turkey season. Currently, all but five of the counties in the north and south zones have a fall season that allows for the harvest of up to four hens. Bearded hens make up a small fraction of the hen population. Many hunters rely on a beard as an indicator of a gobbler. Due to the low number of bearded hens available for harvest, this change will have little to no impact on the Texas Rio Grande turkey population. Internet scoping found over 78% of respondents supported the change in the spring bag from a gobbler-only season to an any bearded bird season. The Texas chapter of the National Wild Turkey Federation has provided me with a letter of support for all three of these proposed regulation changes. A proposal under consideration at the November Commission meeting to add Austin County to the current one gobbler-only spring Rio Grande turkey season is being withdrawn. After further discussion with regional staff, the Wildlife Division believes it is prudent to hold off on the establishment of a turkey season in Austin County. At this time, we do not have sufficient information to support opening the season. We will continue to investigate the possibility and may present this during the next regulatory cycle for turkeys. The last item impacting the current turkey season pertains to a request from the Commission in November to investigate the possibility of expanding the current special fall season in the South Zone to include additional counties. During the November 3, 2010 Commission meeting, I was asked if it was time to consider expanding the special fall season in South Texas. Following that meeting, Upland Game Bird Program staff met with members of the Texas Parks and Wildlife Upland Game Bird Technical Committee to discuss the proposal. Several key points were presented by the committee during these meetings. The staff feel that the turkey population in the coastal sand plains, where the extended season currently exists, is much more evenly distributed across the landscape, leading to greater densities than what is found outside of the current regulation area. Populations outside of the current regulation area are much more restricted to their range due to the linear nature of their existing turkey habitat. In other words, the turkeys in the coastal sand plains are everywhere due to the wide distribution of available roosting habitat, and turkeys in the rest of the South Zone are only found along riparian corridors. This slide depicts a typical turkey roost in the coastal sand plains. These oak motts and oak woodlands are distributed throughout the coastal sand plains. Height is a real critical factor on roosting habitat. This slide is here to demonstrate the variation in habitat inside and outside of the coastal sand plains. As you can see by the areas delineated in yellow, the available roosting habitat in the coastal sand plain is much more expansive across the ecoregion when compared to the limited linear habitat such as that found in Duval County. Duval County is much more representative of the area outside of the current regulation area. Turkey roosts outside of the coastal sand plains are found almost exclusively along riparian corridors. Many of the historic roosts along these riparian systems have disappeared. Some managers have resorted to replacing historic roost sites with artificial roosts to preserve their turkey populations. Due to the lack of population data and hen harvest data, it is difficult to determine the potential impacts of an expanded season outside of the coastal sand plains region of South Texas. Therefore, considering the information provided by our biologists and the Upland Game Bird Technical Committee, is the recommendation of the Wildlife Division that the fall either sex season ending the last Sunday in February not be expanded at this time. The last proposal.
Before you do all
yes,
that,
sir.
Do these, in that last slide, these artificial roofs work?
They're used. They're not used to the extent that natural roof sites will be used. And that's not really a, in my opinion, a landscape approach to restoring original habitat. We need to provide natural vegetation. But certainly, in a year like this where you've had good reproduction, we do find birds using these artificial roost sites. And power lines across the range have been used in the past. So there are artificial roosts that are being used. The last proposal is modification to the current mule deer managed land deer program. We're proposing a minor change to the mule deer MLDP that is primarily a housekeeping measure. We'd like to clarify the rules to state that MLD permits for mule deer are valid during the archery-only season for the take the mule deer with legal archery equipment. This modification will help clear up any confusion with respect to when tags can be used. At the conclusion of my presentation during the November Commission meeting, this committee inquired about the potential of expanding the mule deer MLDP season. Staff has since developed a plan to survey MLDP cooperators as well as an equal number of randomly selected non-MLDP cooperators in an attempt to solicit input on this idea. This opinion survey will be conducted in the spring of 2012 and results will be discussed among the Mule Deer Technical Committee during the summer of 2012. Staff will be prepared to brief the Commission on survey results and staff discussions in November of 2012. And determine if such a rule change should be proposed the following January. This timeline fits within the four-year mule deer regulation cycle. At this time, staff requests permission to publish the proposed changes in the Texas Register.
I have a question.
Yes.
How on the MLDP or the archery for mule deer prior to now, though we're not using if you had an MLDP, the MLDP tags were not being used on the deer, is that right? They're using a tag off a license, or how is that?
I'd ask Mitch to cover that.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Mitch Lockwood, Big Game Program Director. Currently, the way the regulation states, the MLD permit is not valid during archery season. However, by MLDP regulations, once one is issued MLD permits, they would be in violation of not tagging a deer that was harvested with an MLDP permit. So we have a conflict there. So if one were to be issued MLD permits during archery season and takes the deer legally by archery means, the regulations state that he must attach that permit to the deer. But then we have this conflict which says that permit's not even valid to be used during that time period. So this would simply state that this regulation change, this proposed change, would simply allow one to continue harvesting mule deer with archery equipment during archery season, but would allow him to follow the law to tag that deer with an MLD permit. It's really just a conflict between two rules that we have.
No way to accelerate this evaluation that you're now talking about taking place in the 2012 season. We can't do that this spring. We consideration next January.
For the turkey season?
No, for the
mule deer.
I'd like to go ahead and ask Clayton Wolf to come up and visit with you about the regulation cycle that we have in place.
Commissioners, I'm Clayton Wolf, the Wildlife Division Director. In response to the question, Commissioner Duggins, during the last session when we came with our whitetail deer regulations package and didn't anticipate that stacked on top of regulatory changes from the session, we actually stumbled into an immense workload. And at that point, we made the recommendation to our leadership that we needed to come up with a plan to distribute our workload, not only in and of itself, but also to stagger it with regulatory sessions. I mean, with our sessions downtown, simply because of a workload issue. The other concept that we're looking at are asking for regulatory changes and then having enough time to collect enough points through time and data to be able to measure if there's any impact. And so as a result of that, and it's in draft form now, we actually have a proposed regulatory cycle that staggers white-tailed deer with other big game, with our game birds and even our non-game to try to address that. Obviously, it's at the discretion of this commission if there's a recommendation to stray from that, but it is primarily driven from a workload standpoint and also having enough time to be able to measure any changes. And we understand that housekeeping measures such as this one that Jason presented are obviously going to come and go. So that's our staff's preference on that, is to deal with these one at a time. One other thing, we did find ourselves in a situation where we were continually changing deer regulations, for instance, and it was meaning annual changes to our outdoor annual for deer, causing confusion among our hunters out there as well. And so we felt that if we could adopt a regulations package and stick with it for a minimum of 3 or 4 years, there would be some consistency, and then we would attack those at one time.
Well, you can only do what you can do, I understand that, but I sure think we ought to at least make a good faith effort to try to accelerate that if it's possible without compromising prior commitments and obviously exceeding the reasonable workload.
I can tell you that our next cycle that's coming up is our white-tailed deer cycle, and that can be a pretty heavy workload, probably our biggest. Of course, I'm not predicting we're going to have a lot of changes yet, but typically a lot of folks are interested in white-tailed deer, and one thing we have attempted to do is just focus on white-tailed deer in a non-legislative year. And only focus on white-tailed deer, but you know, we'll take direction from this commission if we need to accelerate that for mule deer MLDP permits.
Well, as I say, it's not a directive, it's just a request from one person if it's feasible and practical that we try to move it up, because I think it's important that we do spend an enormous amount of time on white-tailed deer, and I realize that frustrates many of me, but
We'll take that into consideration and go back and visit with staff, and obviously a lot of that would be dependent upon what our anticipated workload is during this next cycle for white-tailed deer regulations. Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Jason, thank you. I will authorize staff to publish the proposed changes in Texas Register for the required public comment period. Committee item number 3, 2011-2012, fishing truck control. Request permission to publish proposed changes in Texas Register. Mr. Robin, again, please make your presentation.
Chairman and Commissioners, my name is Robin Rikers, Director of Coastal Fisheries, and I'm here to present to you the 2011-2012 Coastal Fisheries statewide proposals. Obviously, when we visited in November about this, we discussed spotted sea trout and various conservation measures that we would scope in regards to spotted sea trout, including a 5-fish limit, a 7-fish limit, and 16-inch minimum kind of size limit notion. Since that November meeting, we have ran across a few corrections and clarifications I want to bring to you, and we would like to forward those as proposals, and that's corrections to the minimum link limits on gag, grouper, and snook, which were just inadvertently in one of the revisions as we split the recreational commercial proclamation. We had some issues with those minimum link limits. A clarification to our circle hook rule, where we require circle hooks when fishing for red snapper. Been some question as to whether that applies to natural baits only or whether it applies to natural baits and something you might buy off the shelf as an artificial. The intent and in compliance with the federal rule, we want that to apply to only those natural baits or use with natural baits. And then lastly, a clarification of our rule regarding bycatch retention on shrimp boats. We're matching our proclamation now to more closely mirror the language in the statute and reduce any confusion associated with that, whereby anyone aboard a shrimp vessel who would like to retain a recreational bag limit, they actually have to be the person with a license, whether it's the shrimp boat license itself, the owner of the boat, or whether it's someone on board who has a captain's license. Other deckhands on board that boat can be exempted from the license with someone else having a shrimp boat captain's license on board. But if they want to possess a recreational limit, they're going to have to go get that captain's license as well. So just a point of clarification and corrections in regard to those few items. Next, we'll switch and talk about our scoping in regards to spotted sea trout. To kind of remind everyone, when we talk about spotted sea trout, we hear a lot of discussions about what's happening to the overall fishing effort on the Texas coast. And I showed this slide to you last time indicating that actually overall fishing effort since about the time frame in 2000 has basically remained relatively flat, the green line there. Fortunately, our license sales have continued to grow a little bit. It just means they're not being as efficient out there. So that's okay for the resource, and it's okay for us as well. When we go back to the status of spotted sea trout, I showed you kind of the overall coast-wide status last time, which indicated that we weren't in any overfished state, relatively flat as far as our overall gill nets go, our overall abundance, and particularly in the areas of San Antonio Bay, Aransas Bay, and Matagorda Bay systems where we've had most of the concern. I indicated to you that we're actually having some tremendous bag seine recruitment years. In fact, Aransas Bay had the last three have been record high levels, and we've also experienced some record highs in San Antonio Bay as well as East Matagorda Bay also. The other thing I pointed to was an increasing abundance of what we'll call sublegal fish, those fish in our gill nets that we start to see prior to them entering into the fishery where they're actually within the legal limit. And in those systems, we were starting to see those rise, and in fact, last year we started to see that come into especially the fishery in Aransas Bay. Certainly, I think if you just polled it based on phone calls to you or letters to us, we probably had fewer complaints last summer as compared to the summer before, and that's because we were seeing those sublegal fish start to move into that fishery. When we look at our overall angler satisfaction rates, this is a coast-wide rate. This is a satisfaction rating from 0 to 10 that we collect at our creel surveys, at our public boat ramp surveys that we do. And you can see here that during this downward time frame in overall abundance, at least in those three systems, coast-wide, we're still doing quite well, continue to see our satisfaction level go up. Obviously, it's not only associated with spotted sea trout, but it's also associated with red drum. But red drum and spotted sea trout, if you're an angler on the Texas coast, you're typically fishing for one of those two fish a lot of the time. When we look at our scoping meetings, we did hold seven different scoping meetings. As is the case, anytime we talk about spotted sea trout or red drum, we get a lot of attention. I had over 1,240 comments. That was through last Friday afternoon. As you can see, when we talk about favorable to a change, we're talking about favorable to a change of some sort. We didn't say five or seven or what it may be, but those people who were favorable to some sort of change indicated about 50% of those, 49% actually, and 51% weren't favorable to any change at all at the current time. We had about 400 people show up at our hearings, and the rest came via email or web comments. This basically leads us to the staff recommendation, and as indicated, we certainly would like to go forward with those clarifications and corrections, but staff would recommend that we remove spotted sea trout from the proposal or consideration for rule proposal at this time in the 2011-2012 statewide process. Obviously, this fishery is very important to the state of Texas, very important to parks and wildlife and what we do on the coast. So we want to continue to monitor it very, very closely. We want to see if those gains that we expect to see moving through the system as far as those increases in those sublegal fish, we want to see if they show up in our legal fish catches and in our gill nets and our abundance estimates. as we move forward. So we're going to be watching this very closely. Last week, we also presented this to our Coastal Resources Advisory Committee. They unanimously supported the position of staff and recommend that to you as well. But they, too, were very careful in crafting their motion and suggested that they want to see this again at the earliest time possible. So obviously, as we collect our spring gill nets, we'll be going back to them with the information, and we're all going to be watching this very closely as we move forward and hope to see those continued gains that we expect to see just based on our bag seines and our early gill net catches that we've seen so far. With that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I have a question, Robin. In your scoping, are you scoping just on the three bay systems that you talked about, or are you scoping on the entire Texas coast?
No, we went ahead and held scoping over the entire Texas coast. We did go to Sabine. We went had one meeting in Dickinson. We also went to the lower Laguna Madre because we were presenting the results from the five fish bag limit down there as well. Certainly that question has come up. One of our issues is we have a very mobile fleet, and so you may be in the Galveston area or you may be kind of in southwest Houston, but you may fish in Galveston or you may also fish further down the coast. So the other part to that is if we draw or if we have rule changes and it's not coast-wide, those other areas can be impacted by shifts in angling effort there as well. So, you know, we did go further abroad as far as scoping this from a coast-wide perspective.
In the scoping meetings you held in the areas that there's been concerns, was there a difference? Was there a difference in the 50-50 or the 49-51 that you showed? I'm just curious.
Well, and I can say is in Port Arthur and Galveston, of course, they're kind of at a record high with some of their fisheries. Pretty much it was adamantly opposed, or at least no one willing to stand up in the room and say they wanted to consider conservation measures. Can't say there weren't some there, but they weren't willing to speak. As we moved down the coast, you certainly saw more of a willingness to have that discussion. I will say, though, that one of the hearts of the area, Port Lavaca, I was at that meeting, and there wasn't a lot of support in the room for changes there. Amazingly enough, as you get to Corpus Christi, where we have packed the room with over 100 people, not necessarily in one of those areas that of concern, but there was more willingness to change there probably than the other places that we held meetings. So it's a little bit of a mixed bag, but generally, as a rule, as you move further down, you got more willingness to have a discussion about those conservation measures.
And we're follow up on his question. Would you say that the majority of those who attended the meetings were private anglers or were they captains?
It's always hard to get a complete read on that, but you know, I would say that they probably mostly were private anglers, but we did have a good guide contingency show up at several of the meetings. Typically, so more private, but there was good guide folks there, or people with guide licenses there. Questions?
Well, all in all, I mean, we made some changes south, of course.
Yes.
Fisheries did pretty well. Can you give us, you know, kind of,
yeah,
of course, I'm asking the opposite of the scientists, but also anecdotally. I mean, it just...
Well, the fishery is doing well, though that's not to minimize those overall gill net reductions that we saw in those three systems, and that's overall abundance. That's once they recruit to that gear that we sample with, and that's, you know, they start at about 12 inches and they go on up in range, so it includes those sublegals as well as those legals. I mean, we definitely did see a real decline in those systems, and so we're not minimizing that. It's just that we've been watching it very closely, and it looks as if we have a lot of fish coming up through the system. It's kind of arrested itself, if you will. And we think we're going to reap those benefits of those strong year classes as we move forward. But we want to watch that very closely. But as a whole, yes, I think the fishery last year anecdotally did better than it did the summer before. And you know, I think we will continue to see that just because of those year classes.
Didn't we have a freeze last year that...
We did have a small freeze last year. It did affect parts of San Antonio Bay. That's where we had the most kill as far as spotted sea trout go. It wasn't real large in number as compared to past freezes, but there was some impact there in that system last year. I want to say it was around 1,200 fish is what I'm remembering our count being.
Drought, hit freshwater inflow issues a couple of years.
Yeah. We've certainly had, and you know, it may be fishing mortality, or it's a combination of fishing mortality, environmental impacts, all those things. I had a question last week about could we have predicted these real high recruitment. I said, well, if we could have, we could have been real famous at doing that. But, you know, we can tell you what conditions need to be there and what all conditions impact that, but we can't tell you how they all have to line up exactly to get those super high recruitment years that we've had in the last 3 years in Aransas Bay. It's just been very fortunate for us.
Okay, any other questions?
I just have one.
Yes, sir.
The commercial shrimp boat, what was the issue there exactly? You're limited to the bass catch thin fish.
On board a shrimp vessel now, a person who is licensed can keep a recreational bag limit of fish. And because there are deckhands who, if they're someone on board the vessel has a captain's license, the other deckhands can be exempt from having any license. And so there's been
any license.
And so there's been some confusion. And Robert, if I get this wrong, please come and help me out here. But there's been some confusion as to whether or not those individuals could keep a recreational bag limit as well. And the answer is no, they can't. And we're just going in and making it express and the intent very clear that you have to be the holder of that captain's license or hold a captain's license or be the owner of the vessel on board to have that recreational bag limit. You have to be a license holder.
If the deckhand has a recreational license, he can't keep it.
No, he can't. With a recreational license, he can't because they're on a commercial venture at that time.
So it doesn't apply.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Let me ask one question. Are we talking about, like, head boats going offshore? Are we talking about bay boats? Are we talking about shrimping boats? Or?
No, this would mostly apply to Gulf or bay shrimping vessels. I mean, that's all it applies to, actually. I shouldn't say mostly. That's what it applies to, shrimp vessels.
Maybe you said that thing.
Yeah. Tim?
Any other questions or comments? Okay. Again, thanks, Robert.
Morning, Commissioners. My name is Ken Krasowski in the Inland Fisheries Division, and I'm here today to go over our freshwater fishing proposed regulation changes for the coming year. These were ones I outlined for you back in November. We're bringing forward all those that we talked about at that time and also adding some more details to the regulations on our border waters with Louisiana. First off, on the Wheeler Branch, this is a new 180-acre reservoir near Glen Rose that's opening this September. And our goals are to protect and enhance that the new fishery we have developing there. Our proposed regulations are going to a 14 to 21 inch slot limit for largemouth bass, an 18 inch minimum for our smallmouth, and then have the gear restriction to pole and line angling only to help protect that fishery when it's opened and continue the quality fishing into the coming years. On Lake Kyle, another lake that will soon be opening to the public. It's a 12-acre lake south of Austin here near Kyle. It currently has an excellent largemouth bass population, and we're hoping to protect that quality population by the use of regulations. So we're proposing a 14 to 21 slot limit for the bass there also. And this reservoir will also fall under community fishing lake regulations, which has some gear restrictions and some reduced bag limits for a channel and blue catfish. Next, Lake Allen Henry. It's a reservoir near Lubbock. It has produced 25 share lunkers, which is second to fork, and I was thinking I needed to check that with all the fish coming out of OH Ivy to see if that's if their second place is in competition there, but we'll check on that. And our goals there is to allow anglers to harvest some of the smaller spotted bass in there and reduce some of the identification problems between the spotted bass and the largemouth bass. So our proposed change is there to remove the 18-inch minimum for spotted bass, which the reservoir was open with, and combine the spotted and largemouth bass limits to a 5-fish bag with just 2 fish less than 18 inches. And we propose to remove the 18-inch minimum on smallmouth that we had in place there since opening. We did stock smallmouth in there. They haven't developed a population. And some anglers seeing that 18-inch think there's a that kind of denotes that there might be a quality population there, but in fact the population hasn't developed at all, so we will remove that 18-inch and go back to the statewide 14-inch minimum. And I might note that just recently we had a spotted bass caught out of Allen Henry that tentatively had broke the existing state record there, and we're in the process of certifying that. So the pop, in addition to have some small spotted bass, there's some good-sized fish developing there also. Next, on the two reservoirs, Kirby and Lake Palestine. Talking about catfish here, they're very popular game fish in both reservoirs, but both reservoirs have similar population structure. They have abundant slow-growing channel catfish, but the blue catfish there are also abundant, but grow quite well. So our proposed changes there are the goals of those is to sort of is to restructure those populations using angler harvest by reducing some of the competition among the catfish by additional harvest of some of those smaller channel catfish, and the goal there also would be to by the increased harvest of those smaller fish to continue enhanced production of the larger catfish. So we're proposing a regulation there, removing the minimum length limit, allowing a 50 fish daily bag, but limiting the number of fish over 20 inches to 5 fish to protect some of those larger blue catfish and develop that fishery. Next, as I discussed last time, we've been under discussions with Louisiana on trying to get standardization of our border waters. As our goal there is standardized, it's easier enforcement, easier for anglers, easier for everybody to understand there. And both states at this time have agreed upon some proposed changes on Toledo Bend, the Sabine River below Toledo Bend, and Cattle Lake. So I'll try and step through some of these changes here. Some changes that are common to Toledo Bend, the Sabine River, and Cattle Lake for channel catfish. We're going from we have our statewide limits on there, the 12-inch 25-fish bag, and we're going to a no minimum and the 50-fish, which you'll remember is the regulation we have, we're proposing for Kirby and Palestine, so that's kind of a nice byproduct here. When we do make exceptions, we're cognizant of making too many different exceptions to statewide. Here we can make an exemption that we're having on a couple of reservoirs, so a little more understanding among anglers, and also gives us a couple other spots we can see what those regulation change will produce. A minor change on the flathead, we're going from an 18-inch, keeping the 18-inch, just increasing the bag there. The one that has been a sticking point for a number of years between us was the crappie regs there. On Toledo Bend, we currently have a 10-inch with a 50-fish bag. That's specific to Toledo Bend. The other spots, Sabine and Cattle, have a 25 bag. But what we're going to there as a compromise is no minimum length limit, but going back down to 25 fish bag. So we're hoping that'll produce some good fish, continue to produce good fishing in those areas. And then on Sabine River, we decided to try and make regulations on the stretch of the Sabine River below Toledo Bend that were similar to Toledo Bend Reservoir. So these following changes that you see here, the proposals, are the regulations that we have in place on the reservoir. So we'll have the same regulations in place from the reservoir down through the river there. And then finally, on Cattle Lake, we have some changes specific to that. On largemouth bass, we currently have a 14 to 18 inch slot limit there with a 5-fish bag, and we're going to the proposal there to get a standardized regulation with Louisiana is to go to 8-fish bag and combine that with spotted bass, but only allow harvest of 4 fish over 18 inches. Spotted bass, we're just making a minor change there, going to an 8-fish bag, and our white bass, we're just removing the size limit and leaving the 25-fish bag in place. And finally, we have to make a couple changes. We have an existing definition of Toledo Bend Reservoir. We're going to change that upper limit currently at Highway 84 to the Texas-Louisiana state line. There is a sign that marks that, and we also publish GPS coordinates that to give a little more certainty to that, and also the boundaries that this will encompass for Sabine River will be from Toledo Bend Dam downstream to the I-10 bridge, which is the boundary between the coastal and freshwater boundaries. So those are suggested changes on the freshwater side, and we would request your permission to publish those proposed changes in the Texas Register of Public Comment. And attendant with this, we will be scheduling public meetings to gather public input on this in March. So if you have any questions, I'd be...
Again?
Yes, sir. Can you turn to page 33 of the... which one was in our notebook? It's section 57.973, devices, means, and methods.
Number of this thing. 57 point... Yeah, right there.
I was confused by what this is intended to do. First of all, in item A, what does that mean? It's unlawful to fish with more than 100 hooks on all devices. Is that intended to refer to trot line, jugs, limb line?
Just the combination of any of the legal devices would can't exceed 100 hooks. So you could have, I think on trot lines, you could have 50-hook trot lines. Or, you know, however many combination of jug lines.
Then in item B, we say B1, that no person may employ more than 2 devices, i.e. poles or lines, at the same time. But that seems to be limited only to community fishing lakes that are not within or part of a state park. Why wouldn't we have that on all of them?
Well, this was specific to community fishing lakes. We were trying to limit the harvest there. A lot of those lakes were stocking catfish. We want to have as many anglers be able to catch those fish as possible, kind of spread out the harvest. So we've just chosen to do that on the smaller reservoirs at this time.
So we're saying that if you're in what's defined as a community fishing lake, you may have no more than 2 poles, but
correct.
If you're in 4, you can have 100 poles.
Correct.
Thank you.
You the Oregon man?
You got a lot of poles out there. A lot of poles.
Any other questions for Ken? Thank you. There is no further discussion. I'll authorize staff to publish the proposed changes to the Texas Register for the required public comment period. This is number 4. Now, where are we at? Number 4, we were withdrawn. And number 5, we were withdrawn. Okay. So, this committee has completed its business.